Welcome, everyone, to a Baseball America podcast. Along with Jim Callis, I'm John Manuel. Thanks for joining us. It's our Major League Baseball Draft 2013 Signing Deadline Spectacular. And, Jim, I think we've been doing these for 4, 5, 6 years with the Signing Deadline podcast, and they used to have a lot more drama. But the CBA, I guess it's still new, but this is the second year from a draft standpoint that it's been like this. And as you wrote at BaseballAmerica.com in the latest issue of the magazine, and it's online as well, BaseballAmerica.com, the new CBA has kind of sucked a lot of the drama out of the signing process. What's the easiest rationale for why it's been sucked out? Do you think it's more the hard bonus caps that they're pretty hard caps that teams have? Obviously, some significant penalties if you go over your cap, or is the earlier deadline the reason that the drama has been sucked out? Which one do you attribute more for the reason for why things are kind of tidier now than they used to be?
Definitely the former. I mean, what it boils down to is under the old system, before we used to not have a signed deadline before 2007, and then just guys could go on indefinitely. But under the old system, going back to 2000, when MLB tried to informally slot the draft, and they tell teams what they should pay each of the draft picks, and the numbers weren't really reflective of market value. I mean, by the time the old CBA ended, not that this was part of the CBA, the slots they were using in 2011 were I think, even lower than the slots they used in 2005 or 2006.
Right.
But if you signed for more money than MLB thought the pick should deserve, which, was probably, a couple hundred different players in a given draft, MLB would pressure the team and basically not allow the teams to release, or officially announce the signings until right at the end. I mean, the last year before the deadline, it was crazy. I think we went into to the final day of the draft in 2011 with something like, there were 33 first-round picks that year, too. And I want to say I think 23 of them were unsigned going into the final day. I mean,
that was a huge number.
Yeah, and right now we have 16 players total in the first 10 rounds unsigned. The last day in 2011, the team spent $139 million on the draft.
Right.
I'm not misspeaking. $139 million on the draft. Last year with the new rules, with the new rules, what they basically did is because there's now penalties if you spend more than MLB thinks you should spend. And the pick values are much more realistic than the slots, which isn't a surprise since they were negotiated with the union rather than MLB just coming up with them. The MLB's attitude has become, look, we don't have to police this. We have rules. You spend too much, you're gonna get essentially pay a draft tax or lose a draft pick. So we're not going to try to, keep deals under wraps because it really doesn't matter. Just because one team goes crazy on a guy doesn't, I never really bought, John, that just because,
right,
player X got $2 million in the second round, it was going to create havoc with everybody else in the second round. But MLB doesn't care anymore. And so now, as it should be, one of the best things about the new rules, I can sign a guy for $3 million in the eighth round if I want to on draft day and announce it, and MLB doesn't care. So that's
right.
Basically, it comes down to, by having the penalties, MLB doesn't feel like they have to police anything more. If you spend too much, you're going to pay a penalty, so go ahead and announce the deals whenever you want. And it's much more refreshing because, I do think, we all knew. A lot of those deals in the past wouldn't get announced until the last week or the last day had been done months in advance. They just, teams had to sit on them because MLB wouldn't let them release the information.
Yeah, and the other benefit, whether it's to the benefit of the players financially or not, or for anybody, but for us, as if you're a baseball fan and if you're interested in scouting and player development, which if you listen to this podcast, you probably are, is that so many more players are out and playing. And I don't know that I ever thought it was a huge detriment to wait. We had a lot of Scott Boras Corporation's clients that I can think of over the years who held out and had waited and still had very good major league careers. But it did seem like there were a couple guys over the years who that affected, and it seemed like as a group, as an industry, it didn't make sense to draft players, then make them sit for 2 months, and then have them start their careers later. And this seems like a very tangible benefit. It feels like, Jim, has been a lot more players getting out and playing in that first professional season, making their first professional debut the year in which they sign, as opposed to the next year or an instructional league.
Oh, yeah, and I think everybody in baseball would agree with that. I mean, you still get some debate over, okay, I don't like this about the new system, but everybody on all sides likes the fact that guys get out and play, because the thing is, a lot of these guys who had these overslot deals at MLB would keep quiet, and they wouldn't announce them until the end of August, and then the guys, the season's basically over, are high school players, because they have more leverage. You're compensating a lot of those guys for the value of giving up college, which means different things to different people. But, a lot of times, I might pay – a guy $1.5 million in the third round, and instead of him going out and getting 200 at-bats, in the minors, he doesn't play that first year. So then if it's a high school kid, if I want to send him to low class A for what's his first full pro season, that becomes very difficult. He's not prepared. And just to give you an example, Carlos Correa last year, the number one overall pick, and he signed real quick. Carlos Correa got 200 plate appearances, which is almost unheard of under the old system, and has been able to jump to low class A this year at 18 years old, and he's hitting .325 and having a great year. A lot of these guys, Byron Buxton, he signed for $6 million, which under the old system would have been overslot for the number two pick. He would have signed, probably at 11:55 Eastern PM on August 15th, and instead he goes out, he gets 190 plate appearances, and he's already in high class A, and in my mind, is kind of showing he's best prospect in the minor league. There's all kinds of examples of that. It benefits everybody to get guys out playing.
Yeah, and our midseason prospect update is online at baseballamerica.com today, as a matter of fact, and Byron Buxton is number one on that list, and not far behind him is Carlos Correa. So I think that signing benefited both those guys, and I always kind of contrast Buxton with Bubba Starling, who was a guy who needed those extra plate appearances, and was a two-sport guy. And I think he gets unfairly compared to Buxton. I don't want to go off on too much of a tangent, but that was the type of guy, Jim, who really needed to go out instantly and not wait 2 months. And I remember there was gnashing of teeth and some thought that these new CBA rules would preclude and would hurt baseball's opportunity to sign two-sport athletes, but it seems like it actually helps the opportunities to develop two-sport athletes because it does get those players signed quicker and get them more playing time. That's a little tangent. I don't know if you want to talk about that before we kind of dive into the unsigned players.
Sure. I was just going to say, I didn't crunch the numbers this year, but one thing we found last year was, the fear was with the new rules, it's going to be harder to sign high school players, and especially the two-sport guys. And granted, there hasn't been a two-sport guy like Bubba going that high in the draft, since then. But the bottom line is we found, last year the percentages of top high school players who signed were identical to what they were under the old system when you could pay guys what you want, that A, teams found a way, we've seen it with drafting a lot of college seniors in round 6 or 10. Teams will shift money around in their bonus pools to find ways to get high school players signed. And B, this is a new reality. I always use the comment that under the old system, if I'm trying to sign you, John, I could say, John, I can't pay you X amount. And you could say, yeah, you can, Jim. You can pay me whatever you want.
Right.
Now, you can go to our website, and people do this, whether you're an agent or a team, and you can see exactly to the dollar how much you can pay any player without giving up a first-round draft pick, which I don't believe anybody's ever going to purposely give up a first-round draft pick. Maybe somebody will screw something up and accidentally do it. But now it's very obvious what you can afford to pay any one player. And for some high school guys where in the past maybe you would have gotten $1 million, and now under the new reality, the team can only give you $700,000 without forfeiting a first-round pick, a lot of those guys are signing for $700,000. I mean, they're feeling like – I think that in general, guys are feeling like, hey, if they're paying me everything they can, or I can see what they could pay me, I'm getting treated fairly. It may not be as much as somebody got 2-3 years ago, but it's still a lot of money, and I'm going to sign. There's still guys who want to play pro ball now rather than go to college. So, I have not sensed at all that, I haven't run the numbers this year, but baseball is not losing a higher percentage of players to other sports, or a higher percentage of high school players to college ball for 3 years than they were under the old system.
Right, and that's actually one of our questions. But we'll jump right into that one because we, as always, if you want to send questions to us, you can tweet those at us. He's at Jim Callis BA. You're over 30,000 followers now, aren't you?
Yeah, I think I have not checked in a while. I'll do
32.
A quick link. 34,711. So
man, that's impressive. I think I'm around 11,000 and change, 11,264. So that's a modest. I'm impressed with myself. That it's a more modest total when contrasted with that of Twitter giant Jim Callis. So he's at Jim Callis BA. I'm at John Manuel BA. And Mike Rooney, former assistant at Arizona State and a college baseball analyst on ESPNU broadcast, asked, his question was regarding trends. Any trends you've seen in the draft with high school kids giving up college to sign or juniors giving up their senior year to sign? My hope for the new CBA was that more talented players would end up in college. He thought that happened last year, and that he thought the freshman and senior classes in college baseball were stronger. But he feels like he's seeing a ton of college juniors and high school kids signing for the $100,000 or something near that. His official question is, do you see this draft as good, the draft rules as good or bad for the talent level in college baseball? This particular draft, I should say, the 2013 draft. Will the results of this 2013 draft be good for college baseball or not as good for college baseball as maybe someone like Mike Rooney had hoped?
Probably not as much as Mike would have hoped. You know, like I was just saying, I don't even think last year that there was a disproportionate share of talent that went to college either out of high school or for senior season than there would have been, under the old system. I agree. I mean, it's funny. You know, my oldest son's going off to college in the fall, and so I'm still, you know, experiencing. You know, you get sticker shock with orthodonture, and now I have sticker shock with college tuition, and it amazes me. But I mean, you see high school kids signing to play pro ball for like $150,000, $200,000 when, you know, and I know not a lot of guys are on full scholarships. But, when they have the chance to go to college and at least get part of their college education paid for, and I'm a huge proponent, and I'm sure people in pro ball will disagree. And you and I have talked about this. I think talent's talent, that in the vast majority of cases, if a guy's destined to make the big leagues or destined to be a star or destined to be a Hall of Famer, whatever he's going to be, almost every case he's going to reach that or get to where he's going to get, whether he signs out of high school or signs out of college. You know, he may get there a little quicker if he signs out of high school because he's starting his career 3 years earlier.
Yep.
But, you know, just for example, the highest unsigned guy we'll talk about in a couple minutes is Chris Bryant, the number two pick of the Cubs. Chris Bryant, everybody knew who that guy was coming out of high school.
Absolutely.
He had a first-round price tag, and teams didn't quite want to give him that money. There were some questions about his, swing and miss a little bit. Obviously, people could go back in the hot tub time machine. They would have signed Chris Bryant for giving him whatever he wanted. You know,
hot
Colin Moran.
Hot tub time machine.
It was on TV last night when I was flipping channels, so I threw out some hot tub time machine. But even, you know, looking at these college guys, Colin Moran was a guy who wasn't a big-time guy, but we identified him. We wrote him up as a prospect from New York. And Hunter Renfro, the third-highest college player, again, I mean, there was some skepticism about the competition he faced, but I mean, you fell in love with Hunter Renfro coming out of high school in Mississippi.
That's right.
Everybody knew who these guys were. These aren't guys who came out of nowhere and have, and I said they've all helped themselves by going to college, and they're all going to get more money. So anyway, I got sidetracked there. I think when these new rules first came out in November 2011, the initial reaction when we didn't have all the details, we saw kind of like the summary points that MLB put out was, oh my gosh, you know, nobody's going to sign. Everybody's going to go to college. And it's just not the case. We're still finding that guys, you know, there still are a number of guys who want to play pro ball instead of go to college.
Yep.
And they will play pro ball. You know, they'll sign for whatever they can get. And even if that number's less than what it was 2 years ago, a lot of those guys are still signing.
Correct me, and I guess my sense here, Jim, is, and obviously we both talked to a lot of area guys, area scouts, and we're doing draft coverage for the draft preview issue. You talked to a lot more scouting directors and general managers, agents, the people in the negotiations than I do. But my sense with the area guys is that what the new CBA has done is kind of freed up the area guy. Again, there's just so much more information about what it will take to sign. It's not as much a shell game anymore. It's not as much of a mystery. In that, it's still, I mean, there's still a lot of unknown. Everyone kind of plays their information close to the vest. You know, not everyone, but a lot of players, you know, don't exactly want to put their number out before the draft. But it seems that the area scouts, I think, do, I guess with more information they have, it's easier for them to do their job on signability. And they spend more time, I feel like, assessing, and it's not necessarily a number, but this guy wants to play, this guy wants to go to college. And it feels like the clubs and the area scouts do a really good job of identifying the guys who do want to sign and then moving accordingly, lining up their draft boards accordingly. I mean, I feel like they've always done that, but with the new CBA makes it a little bit easier, I think, for them to assess who wants to go, what it will take for someone to sign, and whether they can draft that player or not.
No, you're right. I mean, and they have to, too, because, I mean, it's against rule. It's against the rule, MLB rules. But with this new system where you have a finite amount of money you can spend, and you need to know not just can I get this guy signed, but how much am I going to save, and then can I use it on this other guy, you know, and so on and so on. You have to know, and a lot of times, even though, again, this is against rules, teams are in almost every case in the first 10 rounds, I think teams are contacting the player or contacting his advisor. You know, if I want to draft you in the third round, John, I'm calling you. I'm not just taking you. Even if my area scout has pinned down what your numbers, what your signability is, I'm still calling you before I pick you or calling your advisor.
Yep.
I'm not sure who you select as your advisor, John. But I'm calling your
advisor. I'm advising myself.
There you go. Save a little money. And I'm saying, John, look, you know, this is our slot in the third round. It's $680,000, but we're only going to pay $575,000. Will you sign for $575,000? And if you don't say yes or no, or you might even say yes, but I sense some hesitation, I get a little spooked, I'm not taking you because I need to know exactly. Almost all of these picks, for the most part, not all of them, but almost all these picks, the teams want to know, and they do find out, what is it exactly am I going to have to pay this guy if I take him here so then I can plan the rest of my draft?
Right. And you got to know. You just have to know. And if you're not doing your if the area scout's not doing it, not doing his job, or the organization's not doing his job, you'd see a lot of hard-to-sign guys in the first 10 rounds. Instead, Jim, what we're seeing is, like you said, what was it, 16 guys in the whole first 10 rounds who are unsigned. So let's get to that, kind of the nitty-gritty of the draft. I guess out of those first-round picks, we have 5 first-round picks who are unsigned. We have media reports today by a friend of BA, Matt Stevens. I forget the name of Matt's paper. I always get it wrong. The Dispatch down in the Columbus, Starkville, Mississippi area, reporting that Hunter Renfro is ready to sign. He's one of those guys, ready to sign with the Padres. You have Aaron Judge, 32nd pick overall by the Yankees, one of the 3 Yankees first-round picks. So there are 4 college hitters: Chris Bryant, Colin Moran, Hunter Renfro, Aaron Judge, and then 1 high school pitcher, Phil Bickford. Are any of those contentious, Jim? We'll just put it in the current context. Are any of those contentious by new CBA standards? Would Chris Bryant maybe be the one that has the highest percentage chance of not signing? Is it higher than 5%?
I don't think any of them are contentious, and I'm probably always more optimistic, a little bit more optimistic than I should be, and I think than you are. But I do think these guys are going to sign. And the thing is with Chris Bryant, I mean, I think in most of these cases, I think Hunter Renfro is a separate thing. Hunter Renfro, I think, was just more of a logistical matter where he played real long in the College World Series. They obviously went to the College World Series finals,
yep.
And then with the 4th of July coming up and July 2, teams doing international signings. I think the logistics of figuring out when he was going to take a physical just took a while to map out. So I think, yep, Hunter Renfro is probably the least contentious, and he'll probably be the first guy to sign. These other 4, I think, are all come down to, for the most part, the team wants to sign the guy at the assigned pick value or close to the assigned pick value, maybe a little bit less, and the players are all trying to get over the assigned pick value. I mean, I know – and I wrote a column, the Mark Appel saga, I think, worked out for everybody. Appel, Astros, Pirates, Scott Boras, and Chris Bryant's a Scott Boras guy, too. That assigned pick value number is $6.7 million for Chris Bryant. Now, the values are going to go up next year, but, like, really, the only way Chris Bryant gets more money next year, and he would have less leverage as a senior, the only way,
right,
he gets more money would be if he went 1 or 2. I mean,
right.
The Cubs have money to play with. I mean, I don't think they're necessarily going to give him over slot. Or actually, they're a little bit over budget right now. They could go another $300,000 or so over without giving up a draft pick. I don't know if the Cubs are trying to sign somebody late. They could pay Chris Bryant $7 million, but I just can't see Chris Bryant, even if the Cubs said, look, we're not even giving you 6.7, we're giving you 6 or 6.4, so he gets a little bit more than Mark Appel or whatever. He can't turn that down. So, I mean, I just think it's a case where – I mean, a game of chicken almost, where it's like,
right,
Teams saying, okay, look, we're drawing the line. It's slot or a little bit under slot. And the players are saying, look, we want more than slot. And it's just going to be what it comes down to. I mean, if I had to guess, I mean, the guy who to me would maybe have the highest percentage chance of not signing would be Phil Bickford, and that's not because I don't think they'll sign Phil Bickford or that I'm worried that he's going to, you know, hold out for, you know, his asking price before the draft reportedly was $4.25 million, and the pick has a value of $2.9 million. I don't necessarily think it's $4.25 million or bust. I just think as a high school player, I can see the scenario where he goes to Cal State Fullerton and you know, gets signed. But even with him, you know, the picks were $2.9 million. Is he really going to turn down $2.9
million? Right.
I don't think so. So I don't think any of these are real contentious. I think it's more, you know, you get to the point, too, with the signing deadline a month earlier, John, that if I'm any of these guys, like if Aaron Judge signed, you know, I have Yankees fans every day, you know, oh, what's going on with Judge? Why won't he take the slot? What's going on? Well, if you're Aaron Judge, what does it matter if you sign June 30th or July 12th?
You lose
40 at-bats. I mean,
yep.
You know, it's not going to make any kind of difference for him.
No, it doesn't make any difference. And really, to me, the Bickford's the most interesting guy out of those, like you said, because he's a high school player and because the Blue Jays. We didn't really touch much on Colin Moran. Jim, is this really just the one question I wanted to ask you about Colin, is this more of just kind of like par for the course of the Marlins? The Marlins, the last few years, certainly have a reputation, I think, well-earned, not by their scouts, but by their ownership, for kind of being cheap. And we just saw with Ricky Nolasco with that trade. You know, they didn't really get great prospects from the Dodgers, but they wanted the Dodgers, you know, even with a $36 million and change big league payroll, they wanted someone else to pay for Ricky Nolasco's contract as opposed to getting better prospects back for him. We saw this with Andrew Heaney last year. They've made things contentious, needlessly so, it seems like, in recent years with their top draft picks. Is it a similar scenario playing out here with Colin Moran at 6 overall?
No, you know, it's really not. You know, it's funny because all what you said, I mean, they do have that reputation. And right now they have 3 of their top 5 picks are unsigned. In Colin Moran, Matt Crook, who's a supplemental first-rounder, and Ben DeLuzio, who's a third-rounder. And it's not that they're trying to be cheap or contentious. I just think with Moran, I think they were thrilled Moran was there at 6. They weren't expecting it. Again, I think that's one of these kind of philosophical teams saying, look, he's not worth more than pick value, and the player's saying, I'm worth more than pick value. Colin Moran's not going to turn down $3.5 million if they hold firm at that number. I'd be shocked if he did. I mean, again, I mean, what's
stunning.
You know, I mean, he's going to come back and try to go in the, you know, first 4 or 5 picks next year. You know, their sandwich pick, it's a strange situation. We can't get into a ton of detail because he's going to go to college, and I don't, you know, and there's, but basically the bottom line with Matt Crook is they were going to sign Matt Crook. They were happy to have Matt Crook. Matt Crook was going to be happy to be a Marlin, and an issue arose when he took his physical that the team and Matt Crook's side didn't see eye to eye on. I mean, and it wasn't even contentious. It's just the team felt like, look, with what the results of physical show, we can't sign you. And Matt Crook's side felt like, you know, they got some second opinions, got a clean bill of health. Well, we're not going to sign at a huge discount because he's hurt. You know, under the new CBA, if you have a guy who fails a physical, you either have to offer him 40% of his pick value, which in Crook's chance would have been about $650,000. You have to offer Crook 40% of his pick value, or he becomes a free agent and you don't get a compensation pick for him. So they made that 40% offer, but Matt Crook, whose family is well off and he's happy to go to school, wasn't going to take $1 million off his pick value to sign. And then with the third-round pick, Ben DeLuzio, who's a high school shortstop from Florida, who's a Florida State recruit, I think that's just a case, and there's a few of these, and this happens every year, where the team felt like they knew what it was going to take to get Ben DeLuzio signed, and now Ben DeLuzio is having second thoughts. And I don't even think in that one it's – from my understanding, I don't think it's that Ben DeLuzio is trying to get more money per se. I think he's just rethinking, do I want to go to Florida State or do I want to sign, as opposed to, hey, the number I agreed to isn't enough. I need more money. So I think in all three of those cases, even though the Marlins I think now have more unsigned guys in the first 10 rounds than anybody because the Blue Jays have gotten a lot of their other guys signed the last couple of days. It's not based on the Marlins trying to be cheap or contentious. It's, you know, two of the situations are kind of beyond their control. And I think Moran is just one of these, you know, both sides are going to probably see it out to the end. And, you know, sometime on Friday, you know, one side or the other will give a little bit or they'll meet in the middle and he'll sign with the Marlins.
Yeah, DeLuzio is the other interesting one there. I definitely wanted to get into the whole Marlins thing, but since we were focusing on the first round, but DeLuzio is fascinating because he was not a consensus third round pick. That was maybe what it would take to get him signed. But that's a pretty athletic guy. who would be – I mean, he's one of the guys, where, going back to Mike Rooney's question, Jim, where that would be a difference-making kind of guy for college, for a college program, even like a Florida State that's a good program. Excuse me. I mean, he's athletic. They don't see him as a shortstop necessarily at Florida State, but they have a fifth-year senior, Justin Gonzalez, who would come back and play that position next year. But I know that, you know, just talking to them during the spring, DeLuzio was a guy they really saw as a guy who would have a chance to play shortstop there eventually, but would probably start as a freshman, second base or third base, and be a potential difference maker on a program that's, you know, already had a very strong freshman and sophomore classes there. The talent level of Florida State's really, you know, in my mind, they just gotten a lot more athletic the last couple of years, last 2-3 years as a program. And, you know, this is a guy who, if he does get to school, would be the kind of athlete that was rare to see in college baseball. So I don't know if you would credit the CBA, like you said. Maybe this might be one
where the... And I think I agree with what you're saying. I don't think it is the CBA. I just think, you know, sometimes kids get cold feet, for want of a better term. Where
I think the deadline is the bigger issue here. I think in most cases, I think you're right. I think in most cases, it's the pools and knowing how much money. But sometimes I do think that there are going to be some cases where if the kid's on the fence about signing anyway, about being a professional anyway, maybe the shorter deadline you know, gives him less time to think about it and makes a decision, has to make a decision quicker. The team has less time to lobby. And maybe this is one of those cases where the shorter time frame helps college baseball.
You know, maybe, you know, and I think, too, you know, these guys are 18 years old. And I'm sure on draft day it was very exciting to, you know, Marlins calling, hey, we'll take you in the third round. This is the number. Will you do it? Hey, I'm a third-round pick of the Marlins. You know, we ranked him the 201st best prospect in the draft. He went 80th on draft day. Signing probably seemed real good. And then, you know, I'll give the college programs a lot of credit, too. I mean, these college programs, it's not like they just recruit the guys and sign them in the fall and then, okay, hope to see you in a year. I mean, they really recruit these guys. And I'm sure Florida State's been in his ear and pointing out, look, you know, here's the benefit to going to Florida State. And, again, I mean, I said my oldest son's going to college. You know, we joke all the time, you know, he goes to 5,000, you know, student high school, so he wasn't even on the baseball team. But AJ always asked me, Dad, what would you let me sign for if I was drafted? And I told him, I said, you know, I was thinking about this. And, again, I mean, I've got four kids, and they're all going to go to college. And, you know, I told him, I said, you used to hear $1 million is life-changing money. Well, it's not like you get $1 million out of high school and you never have to work again. I mean, I hate to think of, you know, after taxes, what would be left of $1 million? I'd probably put my four kids through school and I'd have nothing left at that point, let alone buying a house or anything else. And, you know, so I told AJ, I said, you know, be honest, if you were my kid, and I probably have an extreme view on this, your signing price for me would be $2.5 million. And to be honest, if anybody was willing to give you $2.5 million, then you probably could get, you know, AJ's a good student, you probably get a full ride to Stanford or Rice or Vanderbilt.
Exactly.
I'd tell you to go to school and come out in 3 years. So, you know, there's a lot of benefits going to college. I'm sure Florida State has been very happy to point those out to Ben DeLuzio. And, you know, I don't think it's so much the CBA. I just think is, you know, sometimes you get kids who, you know, at one point signing sounds good. And then the more you think about it, you know, maybe college sounds good. So that one will be interesting. I'm not sure which way that one's going to wind up, if they're going to wind up getting him done.
Yeah, that's one of the more intriguing ones. The other one of the more intriguing teams is the Blue Jays. Let's talk about the Toronto Blue Jays. They have Phil Bickford there at 10. Jimmy, you know, the Blue Jays, just as an organization, are just a much more interesting organization now. The last 2-3 years, obviously had a big offseason. You know, with acquiring a lot of major league talent. I think you wrote in our major league preview issue, you weren't convinced. You were not jumping on that bandwagon. You know, those guys were bad in Miami with the Marlins. I'm not, just because they became Blue Jays, I'm not convinced they're going to be good as Blue Jays. Wasn't that your comment, I believe, in the spring?
Yeah, you know, I mean, we all keep falling for this. You know, hey, last year was the Red Sox spent a lot of money, and the Dodgers spent a lot of money, and the Angels spent a lot of money. You know, adding. I'm not second-guessing the move, but, you know, everybody just assumes you've got to make a trade and it's going to make your team a lot better, and it doesn't always work out that way.
Right, exactly. But this is a team that has, at the amateur level, they kind of made a lot of waves. I guess it was 3 years ago when Alex Anthopoulos came on there. They hired a lot of scouts. They have the largest, I guess, complement of area scouts in the industry. And they've taken it's a very different Blue Jays organization than it was under J.P. Ricciardi. It's almost like they're back to the way they used to be prior to J.P. and the Gillick era. But even this, now it's a little twist. it's a very high-risk, high-reward organization when it comes to the draft, Jim. I mean, that's the basic way to put it. And, you know, Bickford, we have him 20th on the BA 500. He goes 10th overall. Like, there was a pretty high pick assignment. And their draft, just because you were drafted as their third pick, like Patrick Murphy was, or their fourth pick by Evan Smith, does not mean you are the third or fourth guy on their board. The way the Blue Jays line up their board, Jim, is as unique as any club in the game, probably. Explain a little bit of how they've run their drafts the last 2 years and how that pertains to some of their unsigned players, specifically Bickford and, I guess, their 11th rounder, Jake Brintz.
Yeah, well, last year, the Blue Jays had a bunch of extra picks when the free agent compensation rules were a little bit different, and they were super aggressive. They basically put all their money into the first three rounds and all their extra picks. And this year they were kind of aggressive too. And you know, it's, if you look at their draft, they almost all their players, in fact all their players in their first 10 rounds were drafted higher than we had them ranked. Not that our rankings are the be all and end all. I mean, Bickford was a guy who had a lot of helium. I don't really think he was a reach at 10. The Royals thought heavily about taking him at number 8.
Right.
And if Phil Bickford had been there at number 34, they might have taken Phil Bickford ahead of Sean Manaea, who they paid $3.5 million to. They were really torn as to between those two guys. But the interesting thing is, like you mentioned, I mean, the second best player, according to our rankings, that Toronto drafted was Rowdy Tellez, who went in the 30th round. And he was a guy who I think was going to go to the Mariners in the second round, thought he was going there. And the Mariners, who considered Austin Wilson with their first-round pick at number 12, get to the second round, and Austin Wilson, the Stanford outfielder, is still there. So they took Austin Wilson, signed him for $1.7 million, which was well over pick value. I think pick value was about 1.1. And then I think Tellez kind of stuck to his guns as to what he thought he might get from the Mariners, which is why he went the 30th round. The third best player that Toronto drafted, again, according to our rankings, which, you know, I'm using for a point of argument, I'm not saying they're the be-all and end-all, was Jake Brintz, who's a left-hander who touched 97. He's a Missouri high school kid who pitched in the Iowa Perfect Game League in the spring. You know, we had him as kind of a third-round talent. He went in the 11th round. The fourth best guy they took was actually their second-round pick, Clinton Holland, who they took with the express purpose of signing, you know, at a deep discount anyway. I think that pick was worth about $1.1 million also. And they had a deal worked out to sign Clinton Holland for $600,000 before they took him. You know, they were going to shift money around.
Right.
And then he had an issue come up in his physical with his elbow. So he actually got a little bit less than that. You know, and so they just draft these guys not in the order necessarily that their talent would dictate. I mean, their third-round pick, Patrick Murphy, interesting high school kid, a right-hander from Arizona. But he didn't pitch this year coming back from Tommy John surgery. You
right.
know, Evan Smith, John, was a guy you dealt with in Alabama. You know, neither he nor Murphy made our top 500, but Evan Smith, he was on the radar, you know, kind of this raw, projectable kid, but they took him in the fourth round. They didn't, by you know, I'm looking here at their bonus list, they didn't pay full pick value for any of the players they drafted in rounds 2 through 10. I mean, rounds 8 through 10 were just pure college seniors who signed for three guys for $11,000 total. You know, they just signed Matt Boyd from Oregon State for $75,000 in the sixth round, and he was a sixth-round talent but a college senior without a ton of leverage, and he got 30% of his pick value. So they've right now built this big war chest of about $1.8 million under budget, you know, compared to what their assigned pick values were in the first 10 rounds, and they still have – you know, a bunch of work to do. You know, they've got Phil Bickford, who, you know, I think, like I said, I think they'll get him signed. They have Tellez. They have, you know, Jake Brintz. You know, I mentioned all three of those guys. I think those are their primary targets. But I also think they're going to be able to go out and you know, and I don't know how much money they're going to have left over, but I think they might try to make a run at some guys like Tanner Cable, who's a right-hander from Northwest Mississippi, or Dane Dunning, who's a high school right-hander from Florida, or Josh Sawyer, high school lefty from Texas. You know, depending on what they can get guys signed for, you know, the Blue Jays are probably going to be the most active team. You know, they might sign another 6, 7, 8 players here between now and Friday.
It'll be fascinating. I know I follow Dunning on Twitter. I mean, he tweeted about a couple weeks ago that he was – actually, I think I may have unfollowed him after this. I was following him during the draft. But he tweeted, like, you know, going to Gainesville. You know, he's a Florida recruit. That kind of thing. So they're a team that could break some colleges' hearts, basically. And it was the way it's sounding. And I'll admit, Evan Smith definitely took me for a loop on draft day in the fourth round. Probably should have been in the BA 500 just from a projection standpoint, but definitely one of the more raw guys. And it's just fascinating. I don't think that, and this is, I guess, to me, Jim, every time that Major League Baseball overhauls its draft rules, there are always unintended consequences. And no, really, we haven't seen anyone find the loophole. I don't even know if there is a real big loophole in these draft rules for the superstar player, for the Strasburg or Harper who comes along. And I don't think there's been a Strasburg or Harper, but you know, next year we might be talking about, you know, Carlos Rodon this way, or Tyler Kolek, the high school kid out of Texas. You know, when you have a high school kid throwing 98, 99 miles an hour, that's kind of a special case. When you have a guy like Rodon who's at his best, has been as good, and I think could have been the number one overall pick in either. In my mind, he would have been the number one talent in either of the last two drafts had he been eligible. So that's a, you know, that could be a quote-unquote special talent. You know, we'll see if you ever find a loophole that way. But I have to imagine that this is an unintended consequence that no one in the commissioner's office or the union thought that teams would be using, you know, 7, 8, 9, or last year the Blue Jays in the fourth round taking college seniors that way and having their second and third and fourth best players on their board being guys taking the 11th and 30th in those kind of rounds. I mean, I don't think it necessarily is bad for the draft, but it's certainly unusual to see a draft board fall like that. I don't think anybody saw this happening.
No, you're right. It's goofy. You know, and because of the way the rules work, too, you know, the bonus pool is the sum of your assigned values for your picks in the first 10 rounds. And after that, you know, for rounds 11 through 40, you can sign a guy for $100,000 and doesn't count anything towards your pool. But anything over that $100,000 does. And what it does, if you take a guy who you suspect might be a difficult sign, let's say Jake Brents in the 11th round or Rowdy Tellez in the 30th round, it basically gives you a free $100,000. If I sign Jake Brents, and I'm not saying he's going to get $1 million, I'll just pick around there. If I sign Jake Brents for $1 million, I do that in the first 10 rounds, $1 million counts against my pool. If I do it in round 11, only $900,000 counts against the pool. The other benefit is if I don't sign a guy in the first 10 rounds, his pool money disappears. So let's say I took Jake Brents on the Blue Jays, and I take Jake Brents with my third pick. You know, he's the third best player. I'm going to take my third pick, and that comes in the third round. That's a $650,000 pick value. If I don't sign him, I lose $650,000 out of my pool that, you know, I can't apply to somebody else. If I don't sign him in the 11th round, I don't lose anything out of my pool. So, you know, you have to have the player get to you. You know, you could get too cute and hope a guy falls out of the first 10 rounds, and then if he doesn't, you know, you don't get a chance to sign him. But there is some strategy to it, and I think it's safe to say, I mean, I think there's no great loophole to come up with extra money or to game the system to get, you know, to get a guy you wouldn't otherwise. And I even think, you know, like you were alluding to with Rodon, you know, versus Strasburg and Harper, I think when you get that super elite draft guy that everybody loves, with this system, there's no benefit to falling. You know, you know, the Yankees might have more money than anybody, you know, in the real world, but in the draft pool, you know, the Yankees are going to be picking, you know, in the 20s. They're going to have like a $5 million draft pool most years. They aren't going to have three extra picks like they did this year, or two extra picks. You know, there's no point in trying to make my client fall to the Yankees at 20 because they're not going to be able to pay him as much.
Exactly.
You know, Carlos Rodon, even if I'm not saying he'll do this, but let's say Carlos Rodon comes out and says, hey, I'm better than Yasiel Puig. I've got to have $45 million, blah, 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 or I'm not signing. I'm going to Japan, and I'll do some convoluted stuff to try to become a free agent. I still, if I'm picking 1-1 next year, which I think is still the Astros as of today, right?
I believe so.
So let's say I'm the Astros, and Carlos Rodon can sell that, and you know next year that if the picks go up by the same amount, that number one pick will probably be worth $8.5 million. I'm still taking Carlos Rodon because, A, if he's one of these, you know, once every 5 years types of talent, the worst thing that's going to happen is I'll get a compensation pick at number two next year, but I'm going to take my shot at Carlos Rodon because I know I can pay him more than anybody else.
Right.
There are no great loopholes to, you know. But you're right, in terms of these seniors, that is an unintended consequence, and I agree with you. I don't think it ruins the draft. I think it's kind of goofy. I wish you just drafted players based on talent. But I mean, the thing is, too, just so the public knows, it's not like Joe Sr., you know, is sitting around on draft day thinking, you know, he's going in the 30th round, and he just hopes he gets a shot, and then – you know, the Blue Jays take him in the 8th round.
Yeah.
And he's like, oh, my God, I'm pumped. I'm, you know, and then they're like, what? I'm only getting $5,000. I mean, again, the team's telling the player, look, we need to save money. We like you. We're taking the 8th round. We're giving you $5,000. Will you sign? And if your answer isn't yes, they'll find another guy.
Yeah, we wrote that last year with the Blue Jays, with Tucker Donahue, and also we'll talk to a Cardinals senior draft, Kyle Bearclaw, if you want to find that story at baseballamerica.com. Just
just to type in Kyle Bearclaw. Not a lot of references to Kyle Bearclaw on there. We don't have our podcasts. We don't have those searchable at baseballamerica.com for all my random Kyle Bearclaw mentions over his 4 years at, I believe it was St. Mary's. I was a Kyle Bearclaw guy, but Tucker Donahue said exactly that last year to me, and Kyle did as well. And Tucker was a fourth-round pick, and he said, I just wanted it. You know, I'll be able to put on my tombstone if I want to. Here's Tucker Donahue, who was a fourth-round pick of the Blue Jays, and it won't say I signed for $5,000. It'll say I was a fourth-round pick. So that mattered to him, and it matters to other college seniors, and that's really kind of been the only loophole, really, that teams have found.
Right, and you know, and the thing is, too, I was going to say, too, the other benefit for you, the player, is to go that high as a college senior, even if you're one of these $5,000 discount guys, an area scout had to go to bat for you. No area
right.
scout is going to put his name on a guy they don't like when the team's saying, hey, who can we get in the eighth round for $5,000 who might be a guy? You know, to go that high, there's an area scout in that organization who said, you know what, I really like this kid, and he's got great makeup, and maybe he's, you know, not a top prospect, but he's going to work hard, and, you know, I think there's a shot. So, again, you know, there's a benefit to the player to go that high, even if you're not getting a high bonus. You know, they're not getting any less than they would have gotten in the 30th round, but like you said, you know, you get the status of, hey, this guy's a fourth-round pick, even if it's kind of convoluted, but you know that somebody in that organization did believe in you enough to say, hey, you know, if we're looking for a discount guy, here's a good one.
Jim, we talked about the Blue Jays and how they have kind of a war chest to work with this week. We expect them to be one of the more active teams. There's three other teams that have pretty significant amounts of money left to spend. We just mentioned the Astros, the Red Sox, and the Rockies. Why don't we touch on the Astros first? And obviously, again, picked number one overall each of the last 2 years. Right now, they're in a tight race to go number one overall again next year. But the Astros, Jim, they have a lot of money, and they've signed. They have a lot of money left in their pool. What, a little bit over $1 million? Is that right?
Yeah, you know, they have $1 million, but because their pool is so high, it's almost $12 million. They can go almost another $600,000 is what I'm trying to say, because they have a $12 million pool. They can go another $600,000 over their pool without losing a pick. So they really have about $1.6 million to play with here, which isn't so much, you know, this is one of the benefits of if you have a bad record, which the Astros obviously had the last couple of years. You know, they took Mark Appel. They gave Mark Appel more money as a college senior than the three highest-paid college seniors in draft history combined had gotten. He got $6.35 million, but because they set the pick value so high for the first three or four picks to give those teams an advantage, they saved about $1.5 million on Mark Appel,
right,
which is why they have so much money to spend. They gave $610,000 to their 10th rounder, and they still have, you know, they could spend another $1.6 million on this draft if they see fit.
So, but at the same time, it's not completely obvious where they're going to spend this money. Do you expect them to spend almost $1.7 million? And if so, upon whom? Who are their primary targets that they would have?
I don't think they'll necessarily spend that. I think the two guys, I think, are their primary. I mean, the thing is, I mean, I'm looking here at the draft list. They've only five, six, seven. There's only nine guys they haven't signed.
Right.
They don't even have that many guys to sign. But I think their two primary targets are Devontae German, who's a raw. I wouldn't call him projected. He's like a beast. He's like 6'5", 240. He's already up to 93. You could see more velocity coming. He's their 11th rounder. I think he's one of their targets. And I think their other primary target is a Canadian shortstop named Daniel Pinero, who's going to Virginia, who I think Connor Glassy did our Canada coverage and wrote he'd have to go in the top five rounds to pass on his commitment to Virginia. Well, I think they can pay both those guys. I mean, they can easily pay both those guys. I don't know their exact asking price, but, I mean, they have the money to get those guys done. I think the other interesting thing to consider, and I will give credit, I don't remember exactly who brought this up, but somebody brought this up to Twitter on me last night, and I was like, you know, that's a good point. You know, you could sign non-drafted free agents,
right,
are essentially the same as guys who weren't drafted, or, I mean, who were drafted after the 10th round. Like, if I take a guy, anybody who's not drafted, who's eligible for the draft, I can sign those guys for $100,000 at no cost to my pool. Now, if I sign a guy for over that, it does count against my pool. And we saw last year the one team that kind of made the move along those lines was the Diamondbacks, or they made the biggest move. They signed Felipe Perez, who we had ranked among the top 100 prospects in the draft, but his UCLA commitment and his price tag led to him not being drafted. He signed for $400,000. So anyway, I have a point to all this. There was a guy, and I can't remember who it was, on Twitter last night, who mentioned to me You know, could the Astros go after a non-drafted free agent? And actually, it was Street JL. I'll give him credit. Street JL on Twitter.
Is that,
you know,
just
on,
is that Justin Street or Houston Street?
It's not. It's a guy named Lee Street who, according to his bio, is a lawyer in Portland, Oregon, who loves the Astros. And he said, could they go after a non-drafted free agent? And yes, that's what they could do. I don't know in particular if they're targeting anybody, but if the Astros were determined to spend the full 1.6, you know, you could sign Devontae German and Pinero, and I don't know how much that'll cost. You'll still have a significant amount of money left over, and yeah, you probably could go get a non-drafted free agent. You know, they might have $500,000 or $800,000 left over.
Are there any obvious? I just was looking at it last night. I didn't see any obvious NDFAs who, you know, could be in this mix. Did you see any obvious targets or?
You know, I haven't looked because most, you know, I looked at one point and I don't have the list in front of me. I tried to look and see, okay, the highest unsigned guys on the BA 500, and a lot of times this comes down to, you know, just a case of you don't know what their signability. You know, there's a couple Texas kids who I wrote up, you know, Tacolini, who's a right-handed pitcher, and Ryan Sluter, who's an athletic outfielder. There's also a catcher from Texas named Tres Barrera. You know, all those guys are interesting. You know, I'd be lying if I told you I knew what those guys wanted,
right,
or, you know, if the Astros have been in context with them. But I mean, there are guys who, you know, I mean, I, you know, again, I don't know specifically, but I mean, I think those guys, some of those guys might be signable for $500,000 or $750,000, and, you know, and you could get them. You know, it's just a matter, you know, of making them. You know, Keegan Thompson was the guy you wrote up, John.
Right.
And he was the other guy. Those were the four guys, I think, in the top 200 who I noticed, high school guys, who weren't drafted. So,
I just was thinking to myself, wait a minute, how did I miss Keegan Thompson? That's an obvious guy who was not drafted. Who would,
right,
I should have,
you know,
picked on him last night.
But the thing is with Keegan Thompson, as you wrote, and this is a guy who starred with the U.S., you know, youth team. But, I mean, the thinking was it was going to take first-round money to sign Keegan Thompson. Well, if that's true, yeah, I don't know if they're going to give him $1.5 million. I guess the answer to that would be no. But so anyway, I mean, yes, there are guys out there who haven't been drafted. You know, how signable they are, you know, I don't really know. But there are a lot of high school players out there.
Well, it's So that's the Astros approach, and it's going to be, you know, it'll be interesting to see what Houston does. I remember it struck me as when they got Appel that, like, they were so far under, and they'd already signed most of their other first 10-round picks, and they drafted. It was a pretty college-heavy draft performance by the Astros. I just didn't see where they were going to be able to spend all their money, and it looks like it may be difficult. The Red Sox.
Yeah, you know, and I was going to say, John, the guy they wanted, I mean, the guy they really wanted, I think, was Sean Manaea. That was my indication that they were hoping to get Sean Manaea with the top pick in the second round. You know, and I wrote this, you know, and I'll toot my own horn here. I was telling Astros fans all year, Mark Appel's going to have leverage. He's not signing for $4.8 million like Carlos Correa.
Right.
He's going to get paid. But because the Astros, you know, that first pick was valued at about $7.8 million, and the Astros' second pick was valued at $1.4 million, that's $9.2 million. Like I said, they could have gone an extra $600,000 over their bonus pool without losing a pick. That would be $9.8 million. You know, that would have fit. They could have signed Mark Appel for $6.3 million or $6.35 million, and Sean Manaea right around $3.55 million, which is what the Royals gave him at 34, and they could afford those guys. And I think that's who they wanted. And you looked, you could see what happened. If, you know, when you're watching the draft, when their second round pick came around, there just aren't a lot of expensive guys to sign this year. The draft wasn't that deep. There aren't that many guys who you're going to give. I mean, there are a few guys out there like Ryan Bolton, Kevin Biggio, and Connor Jones, who I'm sure, you know, it would probably take at least $2 million to sign, and they're not going to get that. But you know, I think Sean Manaea was their guy, and when he was gone, there wasn't really another guy who an obvious guy to take like Lance McCullers was last year in the sandwich round, and they took Andrew Thurman from UC Irvine, whom I like, but Andrew Thurman was a straight-up, full-pick value college junior. It wasn't like he was a tough sign.
Right.
And like you said, I agree with you. I don't necessarily think they can spend all their money. I mean, you can always spend the money. I mean, you could find somebody to take the money, but I don't know if they're going to be able to spend $1.6 million unless they go heavily into some non-drafted free agents.
Yep, that's how it strikes me. You mentioned Ryan Bolt. The Red Sox drafted Ryan Bolt, and the Red Sox are a team that's under their cap. If they go over and pay some tax, roughly $1.1 million, is that what they have left, Jim? Right around that?
Yeah, the Red Sox right now have They have 875, and they could probably go another 250. Yes, it's about 1.1, 1.2. I mean, they still haven't signed their fourth-round pick, Miles
right.
Smith. So that could affect a little bit in terms of what they can go over. And obviously, if they signed him with Miles Smith, just real quickly, they thought they knew what it was going to take to sign him. I think the Mets thought they knew what it was going to take to sign Miles Smith last year out of junior college. And in both cases, that number didn't work. So I don't know if that was for the full pick value or less. But there's a little wiggle room there depending on what they get Miles Smith done if they get him signed between now and Friday.
I guess my point is there are more obvious targets for Boston than there are for Houston. I mean, besides Miles Smith, even after the first 10 rounds, you have Jordan Sheffield, who came into the year ranked very highly. He was not in our first iteration of the top 200 because I overreacted to his Tommy John surgery and dropped him out when we did the BA 500, put him back in there at 88. He and Ryan Bolt are two very similar situations for me, Jim, because they were both injured all spring and they would have been potential first round talents who both had pretty significant injuries and missed basically the entire spring. I think they both played one or two games. Well, Bolt played one game, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, Bolt, because the weather was so bad in Minnesota,
right?
their season was delayed for a while. So the season-opening doubleheader, he injured the meniscus in his knee in the first game, and then when he was running for a ball in the second game, he just went down like he was shot and had some minor surgery. every scout who had, Minnesota was looking forward to seeing Ryan Bolt, and then he gets injured the first day. But, yeah, he barely played. And, with him, I don't think Ryan Bolt's signable. I think he's not that this necessarily means it. He's already said publicly he's definitely going to Nebraska. He went up to Fenway for a recruiting visit, and they just don't have the money to sign him. His asking price before the draft was $2.5 million, which again,
right.
Those aren't always set in stone. But he's not going to sign for $1.3 million. Roughly right now, the Red Sox for a guy after the 10th round can probably go to about $1.2-$1.3 million. I think Sheffield's signable for in that area. What I guess the Red Sox have to decide is, do we have all that money to Jordan Sheffield, who, like you said, probably was a first-round pick before he had Tommy John surgery, and I think teams, as we talked, it's not a guaranteed bounce back from Tommy John, but teams feel pretty good that guys are going to come back from Tommy John. I think we had him, the seventh-best high school prospect in the draft coming into the year. I mean, this guy
Correct.
Was really good. So basically, I think with the Red Sox, regardless of what they do with Miles Smith, and I don't have a great feel whether they're actually going to get him signed, is either you give all your overage to Jordan Sheffield, and I could see a case being made for that, because if you think he's going to come back, you're stealing a first-round talent in the 13th round, or do you maybe divide that up among a couple players? Derek Burkhamper's a projectable Iowa high school kid who might be a guy. Nick Longy is a guy who didn't have a great spring, but some guys like him, high school outfielder from Florida.
He's a Mark Carrion type. He's a right-handed batter, left-handed thrower, just kind of a tougher profile. Good player who I think if he goes to, he's an LSU recruit, and if memory serves, I'm pretty sure that I don't have a scouting report in front of me, but if that guy goes to school, Nick Longy would be a really potentially very impactful college baseball player, because he's also a left-handed pitcher with right-handed power. So he's a split camp kind of guy, and most of the guys I talked to didn't love him this spring because he is a tougher profile, but he is a guy who, if he goes to college, you could see him having a really being impactful as a freshman because he has some present power and has the ability to, to be a lefty reliever at least at the start.
Right. And they got Trevor Morrison, who's a high school shortstop from Washington, Matthew Thace, who's a high school catcher from New Jersey. So anyway, the Red Sox have a bunch of ways that they're going to go. And the Red Sox, we've talked about many times, I think were the most aggressive high revenue team under the previous rules. I mean, they spent and spent and spent, even though they weren't signing a guy for $6 million at the top of the draft because they weren't picking that high. So anyway, I think the Red Sox are definitely going to use their overage. It's just a case, do you give it all to Sheffield, or do you maybe spread it among two or three different guys?
And Sheffield, again, you mentioned the Tommy John. The other kind of complicating factor to me is that he's not just a high school right-hander coming off Tommy John surgery with a Vanderbilt commitment. He's also 6 foot. I think he's listed at 6 foot. I mean, he's just not a big guy, so – I mean, that is a complicating factor for me. I think you'd feel better spending that kind of money on him if he were 6'2", 6'3", as opposed to 5'11", 6 foot. That's also doesn't discount him as a prospect, but I think it's another little factor there. So then the other team, I guess, Jim, that has some money to spend, and maybe we should probably end with this, is the Rockies. And the Rockies, it feels like this is a little bit more of a high school heavy class. By Rocky standards, anyway, they've been one of the more college-heavy clubs. But again, this is a club that signed every pick through the first 19 rounds. Where could if Colorado, they have some money to spend, could they make a run at Kyle Serrano? I don't expect that to happen, but who could they make a run at after the first 10 rounds?
Yeah, you know, and their money basically came from they signed the number three pick, Jonathan Gray, for $4.8 million. And again, I was talking about how the first four picks have very high pick values. His pick was worth $5.6 million. That gave him an $800,000 surplus. And right now they have about a $500,000 surplus, and they could add another $500,000 on top of that if they're willing to pay tax. I don't think $1 million is going to get Kyle Serrano done. I really don't. I think the guys that they might go get would be, you know, among them, Wesley Jones, who's a Georgia high school shortstop. You know, maybe they make a run at Ronnie Gideon, who's a Texas high school third baseman. Then there's a real interesting projectable. I think every high school pitcher from Colorado has to be described as projectable. For some reason, they all seem like they're – this guy's 6'7", 220. Alec Hansen's a guy they can make a run at.
Yeah, he sounds fascinating.
They took Rex Brothers, little brother, Hunter Brothers. I just probably set a record for saying brother most times in one sentence.
Brother. And this was the year of Hunter. We had three Hunters drafted in the first round, Hunter Harvey, Hunter Renfro.
Hunter Renfro.
No, Hunter Green didn't go in the first round.
He went in the second round. But anyway – but yes, yeah, so they have a number of targets there, and I'm looking at our scoreboard of what team. You know, we have a great page at Baseball America. If you go to our draft page, you can go to our draft database. You can see the draft pool spending by team. I'm just going to throw out a couple other names. You know, Oakland has the fifth most money to spend right now. They saved a little bit when Dylan Overton failed his physical, needs Tommy John, their second round pick. They saved about $400,000. I think we're going to see them sign a Hawaii, has a high school catcher named Ilana Akau, 20th round pick. I think he's going to get done. The Angels had the lowest bonus pool of any team. Or I'm sorry, second lowest bonus pool of any team. And have gone extremely, I guess I'll say the word cheap. They've even saved money despite having less than $3 million in their bonus pool. They've only spent $2.6 million.
That's amazing.
I think the guy they're trying to get is a high school right-hander from Texas named Blake Goins, who I think they could sign with pretty much their overage. Cleveland, you know, has a little bit of money. It sounds like Adam Plutko, one of the UCLA aces off the College World Series championship team, that they might get Adam Plutko done. You know, he was their 11th round pick. I think we're going to see him get signed.
And of course, Plutko was kind of busy. I mean, he was occupied, and also probably a little bit miffed that he went in the 11th round. They may have. It seems like all those teams that passed on him in the first 10 rounds did UCLA a favor, because Adam Plutko was outstanding in the postseason, and I think he had a little extra motivation by being passed over in those first 10 rounds. And it wouldn't shock me if they made a run at Heath Quinn either, Jim, there in the 12th round. I know there was another split camp guy, but a high school kid out of Alabama. I think it sounds like Samford expects to get him into campus, but it wouldn't shock me if that was a guy who a team made a run out. But I do I definitely recommend, if you go to the Baseball America MLB draft database page, pretty easy to find. It's on our quick hits, quick clicks in the upper right hand corner of the homepage. You line up all the teams, see the draft pool spending by team. You can click to see all unsigned draftees, and it really just kind of to bring things back around, Jim. It is really amazing to see just how few unsigned picks there are. Early on, we touched real quick before we finished. We touched on Aaron Judge before, just to satisfy all those Yankees fans. Do you see Judge? Any chance you see that guy not signing? He's just going to get that, or do you think he's going to get as much as he can get from the Yankees, basically?
Yeah, I mean, I always am more optimistic, but really, you know, I just don't see him turning down $1.7 million in the end. You know, I might be wrong, but no, I think he'll. You know, I think. At this point, he'll go to the end, see if he can get more in the slot. The Yankees will probably hold firm to slot, and we'll see what happens. And just, I'm going to run through, since there's so few guys, and we went through everybody in the first four rounds. There's eight guys unsigned the first four rounds. There's eight other unsigned guys in rounds 5 through 10. I'm going to run through here real quick.
Sure.
Ben Wetzler with the Phillies, I think he's going to sign. Jason Monda, the sixth-round pick of the Phillies, has said a while back he's not going to sign. He's going back to school, outfielder. The Rays are having trouble. Steven Woods, their sixth-round pick, who was not a BA 500 guy. I think they felt like they knew what it was going to take to sign him, and that's not getting it done. I do think the Giants will sign Nick Vandertag out of UCLA. Pirates are still negotiating with Buddy Borden. The Orioles have Drew Doshi, who probably would have been a fourth-round pick or so, but he tore the ACL in his knee on a – I think he hit the bag funny on a play at first base. I think that's just a case where – my guess is Doshi will probably sign. But they're waiting to see how much money the Orioles are going to have left over at the end and try to get a little over slot. Right now they're about 200 under slot and could go another 300. So his pick value in the seventh round is about $164,000,
yeah.
And I think he'll get more than that, but he'll sign. The Twins in the eighth round took Dustin DeMuth, the third baseman on Indiana's College World Series team. And they actually took, I think, in the 26th round, Indiana's closer, Ryan Halsted.
Yeah.
And I know they felt like they had commitments from both players as to what they were going to sign for. And Indiana's done a good job re-recruiting those guys. I don't think either one of those guys is going to sign. And then the last guy in the top 10 rounds is Cleveland's 10th round pick, Ross Kivett, the second baseman on Kansas State, surprising super regional team this year, has said he's going back to school. I don't think that's necessarily 100% a lock, but they might wind up not getting Ross Kivett done. So just counting this up in my head, I think there's a chance that we might see by the time the deadline's done, there may not be more than five guys who don't sign out of the first 10 rounds.
That's really amazing, Jim. And that, to me, for all the little things that are different about these draft rules that we may like, may not like, ultimately that's a win for the industry, it feels like. I mean, these rules, I think you have to say, are doing what they were intended to do, which is make this, again, take out some of the drama and make it easier for clubs to sign players, easier for players to know what it will take for them to sign and to get out and get actual professional baseball experience sooner. So it feels like the rules, whether we like them or don't like them, are doing what they were intended to do.
Yeah, I mean, it's...
I think you and I both agree the better system probably would just be, it's nice to have a deadline, but spend what you want to spend. Spend what you think, give the teams, the capitalistic thing to do is have as free a market as it can be and let the teams spend what they want to spend and decide what they want to spend on these players. That's not what MLB has chosen to do, so these rules are kind of, I do think this system is better than what we had from 2007 to 2011.
No, I agree. And what I was going to say, too, is, I mean, I too, would be for the free market and not just, as a capitalist.
I'm a capitalist.
Yeah, I know. But I was going to say, I think the draft, there's no doubt, I think, in anybody's mind, it's the I guess you get more bang for your buck when you're trying to build a team. And if I'm a small revenue team, it's easy for me to spend $15 million on the draft rather than spending $150 million on my major league team. I can spend the $15 million on the draft and try to rebuild that way. The reason this system is better is instead of having these slots, which were unilaterally decided by MLB, that really didn't ever change, and they were basically 2006 slots in 2011, and nobody took them seriously, you have these pick values that were negotiated by both sides. They're more realistic. They're reflective of market value. You don't have to pretend guys haven't signed when they have just because they got extra money. They have given the teams – I mean, face it. The reason we have a draft is to keep bonuses down because these guys get a ton more money as free agents. But, when MLB talks about, the draft, competitive balance, and this and that, one of the things they did do is by giving so much money to the three or four teams at the top of the draft for those top three or four picks in the draft, it gives them a lot more money to play with. So – while it's not easy being an Astros fan because the team has been so bad the last couple of years, the Astros have had so much money to spend on the draft that theoretically in a few years that should help them to get back on top. So I do think this system is definitely playing out better than the old informal system with the old CBA.
Me too. It's it does make I don't miss the deadline either as far as the middle of August, midnight, crazy flood of signings. But I think our web traffic misses it, and I think there are some fans who missed that aspect of it. The drama was pretty fun. We'll have to face it. It was stressful, but it was kind of fun too. So
it was fun, except for when our site would often crash right before the deadline, and we'd be like, "How are we?" I still remember John Manuel, voice of reason, when we our first year we had the Twitter account at Baseball America, the year Strasburg was 1-1. You calmly said, "Hey, we could post these on Twitter," and then we just posted our tweets back on the website when the website came back out. But yeah, it was very odd last year. The other thing is too, instead of having it at midnight, it's now at 5 p.m. Eastern,
yep.
So we don't have to stay up all night. And in the case of Pedro Alvarez and Eric Hosmer, at 12:30 that evening or the next morning, we're wondering, did these guys even sign? But yeah, last year, I mean, the only real drama toward the end was, okay, did Kevin Gausman sign? And we all knew he would, but what exactly did he get? But
right.
I have a feeling on Friday we may have you know, 10 guys in the first 10 rounds unsigned going into Friday, I don't think there's going to be much drama at all.
I got to say, the only reason that that stands out to you, I think, in retrospect from 2009 is that I was the calm one. That's why.
Yes, yes.
That's why it's so unique. So, great stuff, Jim. Fun podcasting with you. My first podcast in a while. So, it was great seeing you in Omaha. Good running into you there. Your next trip is the AAA All-Star Game. Head to Reno, what, a week from today?
I think it is. Maybe it's a week from Tuesday. And actually, there's so little drama. I will be active and online, but I'm picking my daughter up at camp this weekend, so I will be doing my draft deadline coverage, the big Friday coverage.
From Wisconsin?
From Traverse City, Michigan. I will be at a hotel that has Wi-Fi. I've already checked this out. We're getting up at 4 in the morning so we can be there by noon, and I will be good to go. But I will be taking my draft signing deadline coverage for the final day to Traverse City, Michigan, up in northern Michigan.
Are you going to be doing that? Isn't that where Dave Kylitz lives? I believe it is. You can do that from Dave Kylitz.
He lives near Interlochen, which is the camp my daughter is at right now, my youngest daughter. And we actually, when I ran into him in Omaha, he was asking which of my family members had made the trip to Omaha this year. And I realized I made the Michigan connection, and I said, you probably know what Interlochen is. And he talked about how he and his wife go and see concerts there all the time.
Well, now I'm going to take a quick diversion, Jim, because I do want to ask you this. Maybe we can take it off the podcast if you want. But tell me the story about Dave Kylitz. Who was ABCA president before him? Wasn't that when Ron Polk, did he quit for a week as coach of Mississippi State to go try to run the ABCA and fight the NCAA, or did he just talk about quitting? Because Dave Kylitz announced his retirement to me in a letter. And I mean, I wrote about it on Friday, and I'm going to miss Dave. He's a great guy, whether you think he did great things for college baseball or not. You know, I know there are actually some people out there who think he didn't, but they think that he is some kind of commissioner for college baseball and has all this power, and he really doesn't. But he is influential. He's basically the lobbyist for college baseball with the NCAA, and in that capacity, I feel he did a tremendous job. But that post, there was some contention before his 20-year tenure there began, wasn't there?
Yeah, it's like I'm getting old now.
I know it's ancient history. It's 19 years ago.
And I guess Dave's, I think, executive director.
Correct. Well, I don't know what title
I think before him was Dick Bergquist, and before him was Jerry Miles, and that's kind of my tenure since I've been at Baseball America. Ron, I don't think anybody – I'm trying to think of a nice way to put this. I don't think
Ron's an assistant coach for who now? He's an assistant at Wareham in the Cape?
And at the Cape. He's like a volunteer assistant in both places. But Ron hated what Title IX did to college baseball, I guess is the kindest way of putting it. So to make
accurate.
To make a point, he was going – he did resign his job at Mississippi State, and he was going to work with the ABCA – wasn't going to be president, but work with the ABCA to try to stem the tides of these cutbacks. And I remember telling him at the time, because I was still covering college baseball, Ron, I don't think the NCAA cares. Don't do this. You're going to miss coaching, and I don't think it's going to work. And he did it, and he got terribly bored after a year. I think he wound up working with USA Baseball for a while, and then he actually wound up coaching my alma mater, Georgia, for a couple of years before he went back to Mississippi State. But he so wanted to get back into coaching, John. I've told you this story, that when the job came open after Steve Weber left Georgia after winning a national championship and then the program took a downturn, and they hired Robert Sapp, and I won't go into this, belabor this story, which you've heard me tell many times, despite my telling Georgia that the guy you want to hire is Ray Tanner, which I feel as I was correct on, but South Carolina got to him first. So they hired Robert Sapp, and that didn't work out, so they were hiring another coach. Ron Polk called Vince Dooley and said, I want the job. I miss coaching. Please hire me. I want to be Georgia's coach. And the story I've always heard is that Vince Dooley said, Vince was the longtime football coach and athletic director. Georgia said, what would your salary expectation be? And Ron told him, and Vince said, well, Ron, we can't pay you that. We have to pay you at least what we were paying Robert Sapp. I mean, Ron was so bored that he missed coaching. They want to get back into it. So that was the story. You know, Ron did leave Mississippi State to show the NCAA how wrong they were treating college baseball, but the NCAA didn't really care.
No. I mean, I don't think they really cared. I don't think they really had a choice. I think they lost a lawsuit, didn't they? So.
Well, yeah, I mean, here's my two cents on Title IX. I'll probably get a call from Ron if he listens to this podcast. But especially now that I have two daughters.
Do you really think Ron Polk, who doesn't use a computer and uses a, you know, manual typewriter, knows how to use a how to listen to a podcast,
Ferris,
Jim? Come
maybe,
on.
Maybe Cooper Ferris is hooking him up on iTunes or something. I don't know. the Wareham coach. But anyway, with Title IX, my point, I have two daughters. You know, I mean, Title IX was legislation, I believe it was passed in 1972 or 73.
Correct. Yep.
And basically, the colleges ignored it for about 10 or 15 years.
Correct.
And had they implemented what they were supposed to implement back in the 70s, I think it would have been a lot less difficult than what they had to do to make up for it after they got sued 15 years after the fact. You know, had you achieved the balance you were supposed to have between the equity between men's and women's athletics when Title IX first was passed, I think it would have been a lot smoother sailing. And unfortunately, what happened for baseball was because that didn't happen, and you had to, you know, have the right proportions, and you had to cut sports. You know, baseball has a high body count. I think it's 35 athletes, not 35 scholarships.
Right.
But you know, if you're, you know, and you also run into the difficulty that no college I know of has women's football. So if your college has a football team, you already have a lot more male athletes just from football, and that because baseball, I think, is the second highest body count in terms of men's athletics.
You're right.
For a lot of schools, that became one of the easiest ways or the first step to try to get that balance back in whack.
Of course, that 35-man roster, that was not – that cap only happened in the last 5 years. Before that, I mean, that was one of Coach Polk's big arguments, you know, a few years back when the NCAA instituted a 35-man roster limit, you know, 27 players who for your travel roster, and I think 27 of those had to be on scholarship. You know, that's why Polky wears number 36 as a volunteer assistant at UAB to remind the NCAA of that 36 player who didn't get that opportunity. I love Coach Polk's consistency. But yes, I agree with you pretty wholeheartedly on Title IX is the law of the land. It's not an NCAA rule. It's a federal law. So, and the NCAA kind of had to comply. They really didn't have any choice. And if the schools had tried to comply earlier, I think their compliance would have been a lot less painful for a lot of men's sports. And it's unfortunate that baseball bore a lot of that brunt, but, you know, wrestling has had it much tougher. Almost just got kicked out of the Olympics. I think it's going to get back in now, but that would have been a death blow, to use a Seinfeld reference. That would have been a death blow for wrestling between the NCAA cutting back on wrestling and then if the Olympics had taken it out. So, I mean, yeah, Coach Polk, I remembered that, and that's to me what stands out about Coach Kylitz, and he was a coach at Central Michigan, about Dave Kylitz, is that college baseball has grown so much. And really, Jim, just from the early to mid-90s when you were the beat writer, to see, while the talent level is not in college baseball what it was, say, in the mid-80s, the golden age of college baseball, from a talent perspective, I do think this is a golden age for college baseball in terms of interest with the growth on TV, the number of programs building their ballparks and drawing fans, and the attendance in college baseball, both in Omaha and leading up to it. I do think that Dave Kylitz had a lot to do with that by working within the system as opposed to trying to constantly go at the NCAA and attack the NCAA. He just lobbied for baseball's interests within the NCAA, and I think that's been very effective. It may not be, you know, what maybe everyone in college baseball thinks would be the absolute best thing for college baseball, but it was maybe a lot of the most realistic growth and realistic progress that college baseball could make within that system, and I think Dave deserves a lot of credit for that.
I think you're right, John, because, I mean, you hit the nail on the head. I mean, it'd be easy to rail against the inequities that college baseball faces compared to other sports, but that isn't necessarily going to do any good, and I think
right.
You hit the – you know, and the other thing, and you pointed this out in the article you wrote online – it's not like Dave's constituency is unified. I mean, you have a lot of different, you know, self-interests. You know, the ACC and the SEC have a little different perspective on what college baseball should be than teams in the Northeast or teams in the Big Ten. I mean, it's not a level playing field. There's different conditions people are dealing with, and he's trying to satisfy a number of constituencies and work with the NCAA, which – is
very
I'll be kind. I'll only use the word. Yeah, there you go. I was gonna say labyrinthine organization, but yeah, it's to put it nicely, it's a challenging task to have to work with the NCAA and everything that entails. And I think I agree with you. You obviously have covered college baseball a lot more directly than I do these days. But that's been my sense as well, is that rather than get angry about what baseball doesn't have or lost or should have but can't get, I think Dave has done a very good job of trying to get everything he could and maybe make incremental gains as he could. And, baseball is, I mean, it's a lot different than when I stopped covering, stopped being our beat writer, 16 years ago. I mean, college baseball is radically different. I mean, the postseason's a lot better. You have even more new parks. You have even more thriving teams. We still see new faces in Omaha, it seems, almost every year. I think there are more – well, there have been cutbacks, and there have been more schools dropping baseball. I do think that there's more – I won't even use the word parity, because parity almost implies everybody's coming back to the pack. There are more good programs, I don't think there's any question, and more new ballparks and more successful, baseball – programs, financially and on the field, than I think ever before.
I think college baseball is in the best shape it's ever been. It may not have the high-level talent that did in the 80s, but that has nothing to do with the quality of college baseball. It has to do with, it's not because of college baseball. It has to do with major league teams learning their lesson of, we're not going to not sign Barry Bonds over $6,000. We're going to do what it takes to sign amateur players because Major League Baseball has valued the draft and valued amateur prospects better. That has siphoned off some top-end talent from college baseball, but I think the colleges deserve a lot of credit. We were just talking in the podcast, you were just talking about Indiana and those two players who may not sign with the Twins. Indiana is a great example of a program that really signs and develops players very, very well. North Carolina, I mean, I know he was kind of a guy out of high school, but Colin Moran wasn't drafted out of high school. I talked to two cross-checkers this year who said, no, I didn't see – they were national guys. They said, no, I didn't see Colin Moran in high school because our team didn't turn him in. I think he was only turned in by like three or four teams. We may have written about him, but he was not a consensus guy out of high school and became the sixth overall pick. And I think North Carolina deserves credit for developing Colin Moran. I think, Mississippi State deserves some credit for developing Hunter Renfrow. Teams liked him, but no one liked him enough to draft him higher than the 31st round. I don't remember how much the Red Sox offered him, but it wasn't huge. He's obviously going to his investment of his 3 years in time in Mississippi State will pay off quite well with a College Series finals trip and the signing bonus he's going to get this week. So, I think Dave has presided over a very good era in college baseball. We're not here to, knock Coach Polk. His passion and his heart's in the right place. His passion is definitely earnest and I respect greatly, but I think his approach would not have gotten college baseball to the position it's in now, whereas Dave Kylitz's did. So, interesting sidebar at the end, but I meant to ask you that before off the air, and it was a fun discussion to have on the air. So, good stuff, Jim. Sorry I took 80 minutes of your time on the podcast, but we hope everybody here enjoyed it. And you'll be on MLB Network next week, right, for the AAA All-Star Game.
Right, which is the 17th, which is Wednesday, I believe. I got to figure out. It might be the 16th. I should know. It's the 17th because I fly out to Reno on the 16th.
You've got time to figure
now,
it out.
That's the story I'm sticking to. I'm going to broadcast that on Wednesdays.
Who are you on with? You and Hambone, I believe?
Yeah, and I think Phil Severino, too.
Paul Severino.
Sorry,
Darryl,
Paul.
Darryl Hamilton, Jim Callis. On your AAA All-Star broadcast, I have to admit I will not be watching at the beach. I don't believe my beach house next week that we're renting has MLB Network. So
well, maybe hopefully I'll Ron Paul will be watching me. So
it'll be on late. So, but we'll look forward. So if you want more Jim Callis, you get it every Friday on MLB Network during the rundown for our prospect hot sheet. You get him every Wednesday at BaseballAmerica.com chatting, and you'll get him next week on the AAA All-Star Game broadcast on MLB Network. So thanks, Jim, multimedia star. Thanks for taking the time.
That was good. Good talking to you, John. And it's easy to take the time because there's nobody signing because they've all signed already.
So. That's right. We had time to spare today. So for Jim Callis, I'm John Manuel. We'll see you on the next Baseball America podcast. So long, everybody.